Well, greetings once again to everybody out there at TFMR. It is Thursday, December the 8th. Earlier today, we had scheduled an A2A webinar, and unfortunately, as I discussed yesterday on the site, I'm going through some rewiring and reconfiguration of the internet here at Turd Fork, and that really blew up today and left me without internet access. And so thankfully, since we had to cancel A2A, thankfully, Rob Kirby, our guest, is such a wonderful, patient man. It's a good compliment, right, Rob?
I love it.
Wonderful, patient man who's willing to put up with all of these frustrations on my end. It's too late to try to reschedule A2A. We'll try that again, perhaps as soon as we get into the new year. But while I had Rob available and he'd set aside the time, I thought, there's a couple of things we got to get out there and talk about. So thankfully, Rob's going to record this quick podcast for everybody. Rob, thank you so much for taking the time.
Pleasure to be with you.
Again, Rob Kirby, head of Kirby Analytics. Rob, your background, though originally, is in derivatives, correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, tell everybody a little bit about your background so they know where you're coming from and your level of expertise.
Well, I got out of university in 1983 with a degree in economics, and I went to work on Bay Street in Canada, which is the equivalent of Wall Street in America. And I went to work for an interdealer broker of foreign exchange and interest rate products. The name of the company at the time was, its current incarnation is called Prebon Tullett. And our customers were banks and investment dealers around the world. And we disseminated pricing in euro dollar deposits, foreign exchange, and interest rate derivatives as they were incubated primarily here in Toronto, Canada, due to some quirky adaptations in our Bank Act. Canada went from having basically five banks in 1980 to having like 83 banks overnight, because foreign banks were with a stroke of a pen, foreign banks were allowed to set up operations in Canada. And when this occurred, the existing Canadian banks had lobbied with the politicos in our country to put limitations on foreign banks as they entered by putting capital restrictions on them, which meant that traditional treasury operations that are done in banking centers where banks can operate as full branches of the parent, capital restrictions in Canada, explicitly meaning that foreign banks in Canada were only allowed $5 million in paid up capital when they first opened their doors here. So that meant they didn't have balance sheet that would allow them to do like trading the yield curve, lending long, funding short, which is a typical treasury function for banks all around the world. This is stuff that they engage in every day.
Right.
Banks in Canada didn't have room to do this because they had balance sheet restrictions, and therefore it was primarily the American banks. Specifically, it was Chase Manhattan, Citibank, and Chemical Bank at the time. They went on a hiring binge and hired a bunch of PhDs and high-powered thinkers to effectively synthetically create instruments that would allow them to trade the yield curve without doing so on balance sheet. So this is where this gave rise to the off-balance sheet trade that we know as interest rate derivatives. And interest rate derivatives in a large way consist of two basic products, and that is the FRA, or forward rate agreement, which is a basically glorified bet on what LIBOR is going to be 1 month to 1 year in the future.
Okay.
and interest rate swaps, which is an exchange of floating for fixed rate obligations, and these trades are traded as a spread over treasuries. But the big takeaway from this is these things are and this trade is conducted in the OTC or over the counter market, where they aren't cleared on an exchange and they're off balance sheet, which means that banks could synthetically trade the yield curve without and skirt the capital restrictions that were placed on them in this country. So anyway, this trade off balance sheet in interest rate derivatives, which was incubated here in Toronto, it caught on and it grew geometrically very quickly.
All right. With that as a background, then that's going to segue us into the two things that I wanted to talk about in the A2A today. And we'll just focus on those two. And like I said, we'll get back at a later date and let everybody pose their specific questions to you. Before we get to the silver case, because there's some news on that here today that broke yesterday, and you were instrumental in alerting everybody to that back in the spring of this year. I did want to ask you, though, about interest rate derivatives, because over the past, well, really since July, when a lot of long rates bottomed out, but particularly since the end of September, and especially since the election of Donald Trump, we've seen this huge move in long rates. U.S. long bond got to 210. It's now 310. The move in the 10-year note on a percentage basis is something like 60% since the election. And what I don't know, and what it's hard for, I guess, anybody to know, but I'd like you to shed some light on it, is what is the potential impact under the surface that is now going to come bubbling up through this, all of these derivative exposures in the interest rate swaps and the interest rate derivatives, of such a massive percentage move in such a short period of time? Can you explain what is happening behind the scenes and when this all might move to the forefront over time?
Well, I would first state that most mainstream commentators would try to have you believe or would tell you that the outrageously large notional amounts that the big derivatives players have on their books. And when I say outrageously large, we'll take, for instance, Citibank and JP Morgan are in terms of notional size in their derivatives book, and this is at Q2 2016, so as of the end of June,
right.
Citibank had reported a book of $53.6 trillion in notional size, and JP Morgan, $52.7 trillion in notional size.
Uh-huh.
And most mainstream commentators would have you believe that this is all hedged.
Right, that's what they say.
But what I would offer to anybody who's walking around armed with that assumption, the hedges are dynamic in nature, and that rude movements in the interest rates, which they're hedged against, can cause let's just say pretty crazy and wild swings in P&L at the institutions if they're not managed properly or adequately. But what I would like to throw, it's like maybe throwing a bit of a wet blanket on that whole line of thought.
Okay.
Because I'm gonna pose the question is, you're asking what the impact could be because of the huge percentage move, for instance, in the 10-year bond, mm-hmm. the U.S. government security in the last couple months. My answer to you, and I'm not trying to sound flippant, my answer to you is it could have extreme implications to the solvency of the institutions that have these positions. But the bigger question to me is whether these institutions are actually being held and are subject to accounting. And when I make this statement, I don't do it lightly, and I'd like to draw everyone's attention to something that's been in the public, in the public knowledge now for at least 10 years, and this was something that was made known back in 2006 by a by a female reporter with, at the time, she was with the business, she was with Newsweek. And she had, somebody in government had alerted her to a change in where the authority rests to, it was an executive order transferring the ability of the president over to the, at the time, chief intelligence czar, who was at the time John Negroponte. And what this waiver that's been on the books in America since 1934, this waiver, if granted to an, to a company, gave them the right to legally not comply with reporting accurately the true state of their financial condition. So they could effectively, if deemed in the interest of national security, institutions in America can be granted a waiver where they can literally keep two sets of books.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can report whatever they want.
Right.
And all I can say to anybody who wants to listen, the notion that back in 2008, when we had a credit freeze, where banks were not even lending to one another on an overnight basis, and the commercial paper market was locked up, seized, it was during that period of time that none other than Morgan Stanley, who most people in banking circles were very aware that Morgan Stanley, regulators in America were trying to marry Morgan Stanley to anybody. I mean, they did force and arrange a marriage of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
And in the aftermath of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers going under, they were basically absorbed into JP Morgan, and there was a huge wad of cash that got shunted to JP Morgan to sort of smooth out the digestion of Lehman Brothers. And they were looking to marry, I know, Morgan Stanley. They were trying to get Barclays to possibly take them out. Didn't happen. Barclays wouldn't touch them with a barge pole. But lo and behold, it was a 3-month period in the fall of 2008 that Morgan Stanley was able to put on, and this brings us back full circle to these interest rate derivatives that we were referencing just a little bit earlier. Understand that these are credit instruments, and so you need to have credit standing with the counterparty to actually conduct trade in this. And so understand that this was probably the worst credit conditions in the world, and Morgan Stanley was a particularly poor credit at the time. But in 1 3-month period, they grew their interest rate swap segment of their derivatives book. They grew it by $8 trillion in 3 months. And this was at the depths of the credit debacle.
I remember that.
You see, and the notion that Morgan Stanley would have been able to conduct $8 trillion worth of credit-sensitive trade in a 3-month period with the interbank market is a non-starter. I mean, it's so outrageous, Craig. It's like me saying that I can suck 8 elephants through a garden hose.
Right. I mean,
it's preposterous.
So where did it come from then, Rob?
Well, it was the U.S. Treasury recapitalizing Morgan Stanley via stealth by selling them short-dated FRAs at rates below the yield on T-bills, which Morgan Stanley then turned around and bought Treasury bills to lock in risk-free profit on roughly $8 trillion worth of short-dated swaps called FRAs. And this is how they recapitalized Morgan Stanley. And the evidence is still lodged in the quarterly derivatives reports that are archived on the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency site. In their, I mean, you know, it is so astounding that this occurred, and there's been nobody that's ever really in the mainstream that's ever even entertained making a comment on this. And all I can say is $8 trillion in 3 months, and then their book recoiled in the next quarter, and that $8 trillion came right back off, and that's what identifies the exact type of instrument that was used to recapitalize them.
So in present day, Rob, does that level of shenanigans and off-balance sheet transactions and smoke and mirrors, financial smoke and mirrors, apply all the way down to even hedge funds in a sense? If, you know, like a long, you know, long-term capital was a systemic risk in 1998 as things blew up. I mean, what about a massive hedge fund that has now massive underwater derivative positions and the like, levered up how many different times based on interest rates that have moved so massively against them? I mean, could there be, though, a domino effect from something like that?
I mean, it technically there could be, but you know, most hedge funds that would run into problems would literally just be absorbed into the bank that you know,
on the other side
that's given them credit.
Yeah.
Long-term capital was a very special situation back in the late 1990s because, I mean, the long-term capital debacle was a very, very unique situation in that one of the biggest contributors to long-term capital was none other than the Bank of Italy. And the Bank of Italy, the way they made their contribution to or funded their contribution to long-term capital management was, you see, back at the time, you have to understand the scenario and the conditions that existed, because long-term capital management was an infamous hedge fund that was founded by some Nobel laureates, and these guys were taking extremely leveraged positions and were making spectacular returns for the people who had invested money with them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, this was before the inception of the euro currency, and the countries that were to become the original founders of the euro club, one of them included Italy. And Italy at the time had a finance minister, and his name was Mario Draghi. And Mario Draghi and Italy were having trouble qualifying for euro because their sovereign finances were a mess. And so what Mr. Draghi did at the advisement of his chief financial advisors, who were Goldman Sachs at the time. And Goldman Sachs is a bullion bank. And Goldman Sachs, realizing that Italy had a problem qualifying financially, sovereign finance-wise, for the euro inclusion, advised Mr. Draghi to lease some gold. And when gold is leased by sovereigns, what happens is the gold comes out of the vault, it is sold into the market. The proceeds are then free for the, you know, former holder of the gold,
right,
to invest in whatever. So what happened in the case of the Bank of Italy, they leased roughly, the rumors were they leased 300 tons of gold. So the gold left the vault. They then had the money. They took the money, invested it with long-term capital management. Well, long-term capital management then made a huge leverage bet on Russian bonds, and Russia defaulted on those bonds. So therefore, anybody who had money with long-term capital, it disappeared overnight when Russia defaulted on the bonds. So now Italy had a huge problem.
Yeah.
Not only that had they lost the money, but now they didn't have the gold either. And if this had become public knowledge in a public workout, Italy would have been deemed unfit or to qualify financially for inclusion in the euro, and the euro would have very likely been stillborn. Well, the globalists weren't going to allow their little pet project of the euro to be stillborn, so they had their Mr. Fix-It, who was none other than James Rickards, who at the time was the chief legal counsel of long-term capital management. And they had him do a secretive workout behind closed doors, where everyone who was involved in the workout was sworn to secrecy, because they didn't want the world to know that the Bank of Italy had leased gold, and that gold was sold into the market, which was, you know, serving dual aims on the part of Goldman Sachs, because Goldman Sachs is part of a group that have been, you know, using stealth means to suppress the price of gold, and it's been this sovereign lease mechanism that gold was suppressed with mightily back in the 1990s, and that was all exposed to the world by none other than Frank Veneroso. In his Frank Veneroso did research that was foundational to the forming of GATA, Gold yeah. Antitrust Action Committee.
Fernand Lips and, too.
And it was Frank Veneroso's long relationship with a chap at the Bank of England who managed the gold activities at the Bank of England, and his name was Terry Smeaton. And Terry Smeaton had been telling Frank Veneroso that central banks were leasing vast amounts of gold, which was creating a very, very much of a drag on the price of gold gaining any traction, and was basically artificially putting a cap on the price of gold behind the curtain. So anyway, this is the whole mechanism that was in place at the time of the euro. So when you talk about a hedge fund, there was so much gravity put to the long-term capital debacle was simply because, and the reason it was such a big deal and had to be handled with so quietly and behind the curtain, was because it involved this gold short at the Bank of Italy and the implications for the euro. And it was Mr. Rickards who did the workout in quiet. Remarkable. And this is why Mr. Rickards can prance around the world saying that he knows the price of gold has to go up, because Mr. Rickards is very aware of the shenanigans that went on many years ago in the gold market, and especially as it relates to the Bank of Italy and long-term capital management. So Mr. Rickards is very aware that the gold market is rigged beyond belief.
Remarkable. All right. So yep. To that end, because I want to be further respectful of your time, because I've taken so much of it today, let's just have one more topic. I want to segue that into this silver manipulation, silver price rigging lawsuit that we got a further update on just yesterday on Wednesday the 7th. It's now quite clear that this is a significant deal. You had kind of warned everybody this was coming last spring. Deutsche Bank, under what we presume to be pressure from the German regulator BaFin, decided to settle. They've now settled their involvement in this particular suit for almost $100 million for gold and silver. More importantly, though, they've become state's evidence and are working with the claimants, if you will, providing information. This has led this suit to finally move through to the discovery phase for the first time we've ever had one do this. They've all been thrown out before we could ever get to the discovery phase. And so now we've got subpoenas, affidavits, depositions, and some of that subpoenas have today, or at least were released yesterday, some actual text messages and chat room information showing the collusion, showing the manipulation between bullion bank traders. I know, though, you're connecting these dots into maybe a bigger picture. And so with that as, a setup, Rob, let me just let you take the mic from here and tell everybody what you're seeing and thinking and concluding.
Well, at the end of the day, it's been a longstanding running commentary by the gold bugs and by the people that are GATA, which is for namesakes Bill Murphy and Chris Powell, that acknowledging and documenting that our capital markets are basically, I refer to them as a crime scene, and with the suppression that's gone on in the precious metals arena, GATA has long said that this won't end pretty. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to end pretty. And what it will likely entail, it's the shenanigans that have been committed against precious metal in terms of suppressing their true price in the face of just ridiculous currency debasement and printing, outright printing of money. and you know, a printing of currency which is backed by nothing with intrinsic value, which is the U.S. dollar. This will ultimately cost America its standing as the world's reserve currency.
Mm-hmm.
And the revelations and the admissions which are coming forward will produce in time, will produce a run on physical stocks of precious metal that exist in the world right now. And at some point, and I can't tell you which day, but it will occur, people will stop and will not sell physical precious metal for U.S. dollars. So, you know, you can get away with this stuff for so long when you control the system, which is what, you know, I guess what it really comes down to, Craig, to really cut to the punch, America and the people that are in control of the American financial edifice have been extremely poor stewards of the world's reserve currency.
Yes.
The U.S. dollar.
Yes.
And you cannot be a steward that poor and maintain your position of leadership, because it flies in the face of common sense, and it flies in the face of reality. And reality will catch up to these people, and the way it will catch up to them is that the demand for physical metal, and this is an ongoing process. It's been going on for a long time. People realize that if they can't hold it in their hands, they don't own it.
Right.
And promises of precious metal are not the same as ownership of physical precious metal.
Right. Rob, to that end, in this bigger picture of we've got this silver manipulation case that's moving forward, you know, for the first time, and there's a lot going on there. But again, maybe a more significant affecting all markets component is this, let's call it pressure or a perceived pressure from the German regulator BaFin on Deutsche Bank to change the way they're doing business in regards to all derivatives. Can you shed some light on what you're thinking is there? Because I think that's something everybody should hear.
Well, you see, it's no surprise to me, at least. If you know your history, it shouldn't be a surprise that it's the German regulator that is making their institutions get clean, or get cleaner anyway.
Uh-huh.
See, because Germany has been on the wrong side of history,
right?
In the past,
right?
And Germany therefore has a reluctance to go down that road again, to be painted as being on the wrong side of history.
Mm-hmm.
Germany experienced an event where they had a currency, the Reichsmark, that became worthless in the 1920s. And so you see, German people have it sort of tattooed in their DNA that yes, it can happen, and they have memories, and you know, they have families with history that this has happened and can happen, and they don't want to be any part of it happening again. And they don't want to be caught wrong-footed on the wrong side of history again. So it doesn't surprise me at all that it's the German regulator that's laying down, you know, basically laying down the planks and saying, you know what, you as a German, the flagship German financial representative for the German people, are not going to be engaged in activities in the U.S. dollar derivatives marketplace, being seen as one of the key players in perpetuating the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency, because that is not in your job description as a German bank.
Right.
And that's what's literally, that's the rubber hitting the road, because the German regulator has said to their bank, you know, it was BaFin who raided Deutsche Bank's offices back about 3 years ago, and they've been building towards this. You know, they've had Deutsche Bank exit the precious metals markets, and now they've got them exiting the derivatives market, because this the whole upshot of these interest rate derivatives that we were referencing earlier, the whole procedure of having them and the reason why they're there is when the U.S. Treasury is active in these markets, in the size that they're involved in, they effectively make the way the orders work, the Treasury and the Exchange Stabilization Fund at the Treasury is an entity with wealth that's scary,
right?
But it's dark money and it's not on balance sheet, but it's basically a black hole, and my guess is it could be worth tens of trillions of dollars. It's you know, we read and hear about how trillions of dollars, tens of trillions, disappear from the Pentagon. Well, that money, at least in my view, that money ends up in this black hole called the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Treasury has a public side and it has a dark side, and I reckon the dark side is probably as big as the public side, where we see that the U.S. has a $20 trillion debt. And it wouldn't shock me at all to find out that the ESF might have $20 trillion on the other side
yeah.
of the sheet, but they don't talk about it, and they don't even admit that they have it.
Right, right. But that makes sense.
So what happens, the ESF was created in 1934, and its function, when it was created by an act of Congress, it was to basically perpetuate and to underscore or make the dollar a credible unit of exchange, and that's what its job was. So you see, the ESF is the ultimate protector of the dollar, and when they don't report to anyone. The Exchange Stabilization Fund does not produce financials.
Sure,
it is not accountable to Congress. It is operated by the Secretary of the Treasury and the President of the United States, and it is above all laws, and it is allowed to engage in anything, and it's I'll just tell you, it's involved in everything from gun running to regime change to precious metals to interest rate products, and when the ESF has business to do in any market, it gives the orders, especially if it's in the financial markets. The orders are given to their broker, and the ESF's broker is the New York Federal Reserve's trading desk. So the order goes from the ESF to the Fed, and then the Fed disseminates the orders to the banks. And there are five banks that are captive derivatives players in America who execute a very large amount of the ESF's orders in markets. And the five American banks that are the big derivatives houses are JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the guys that have derivatives books, you know, $40 to $53 trillion, and they've been much bigger at different times.
So, Rob, if Deutsche Bank is being pressured to move out of the derivatives business so they're not a systemic risk and a black eye for Germany, kind of fleeing the ship before everybody else, do the U.S. banks, through the intervention of the ESF, just kind of absorb all their positions?
Well, that's
will it make any difference?
That's a very good question, Craig, and it's one that I can't say that I know the answer to it. But I mean, what I do know is that like a year and a half ago, Deutsche Bank had a bigger derivatives book than J.P. Morgan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, just how you unwind, and a year and a half ago, when Deutsche Bank had a book a little bit bigger than J.P. Morgan's, their book was around $75 trillion in notional. So exactly how you unwind or off a $75 trillion derivatives book, I can't say I really know the answer to that, but. What it tells me is there's big problems, and the whole fact the bigger thing is, it's the whole fact that it is clearly the German regulator that's making this order, and what that tells me is there is a rift at the highest levels in financial regulation, between the Germans and the Anglo-American banking complex.
Right. Right.
And, you know, that's friction.
Right.
And when you get that much friction, you get, you know, that generates a lot of heat.
Yeah.
And when you get too much heat, sometimes things start to burn.
Well, and they're obviously singing like a mafia informant in front of the judge in this one particular case revolving, you know, around the gold and silver price rigging. As we wrap, Rob, and I want to be respectful of your time, and I want to get this posted this afternoon. As we wrap, in your mind, I know it's impossible to predict, and things are fluid, and you never know how things are going to move. In your mind, am I seeing this correctly? Does this case lead to more cases where Deutsche Bank has provided the evidence, and now any further case going forward, you got the attorneys seeing the blood in the water and the potential money from the settlements, and now everybody from mining companies to shareholders to traders to investors are going to start lining up for multiple class action suits, which then eventually lead to these bullion banks just getting out of the business, just saying, you know, this just isn't worth it. I mean, could this potentially lead in that direction and then finally lead us to that point where the paper derivative pricing is finally defunct and we move to a different platform?
Well, gee, my answer or my commentary or retort to what you just stated is that Deutsche Bank is widely acknowledged around the world to be a financial institution whose solvency is in question,
mm-hmm.
and is very, very sick.
Right.
And most people would more or less concede that Deutsche Bank's issues tend to stem from their involvement in derivatives.
Right.
And my real claim would be that Deutsche Bank's derivatives book would be a mirror image of what Citi, B of A, JP Morgan, Goldman, and Morgan Stanley have.
Yep.
So if this stuff has buried Deutsche Bank, the American banks that have books the same size or bigger or roughly the same size, they're walking dead as well.
Yeah.
And it's just that nobody has bothered to tell us.
So we might almost get rid of, as it pertains to gold and silver, we might actually get rid of this system just by default because the entire gigantic derivative system finally wobbles and fails.
Yeah, my guess is the way it will manifest is that people will realize that paper promises for anything are not worth the paper they aren't written on, because it's all digitally created.
and
people will and entities will and big money will make a run for physical bullion.
Yeah,
because physical bullion is the only financial asset on the planet that has absolutely no counterparty risk.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what people and smart money will demand,
right,
is, you know, to get as close to zero counterparty risk as they possibly can.
And that's when it definitely ends, because when someone, you know, the confidence game can continue when the parties have confidence that, oh, I can always get my gold whenever I want it. So if you want to lease it out, if you want to hold it unallocated, but allocate it to me whenever I ask. When everybody shows up at once because there's this run, if you will, of people wanting actual physical, that will end it. We won't have to worry about the derivative market.
People, and you just made a very, very good point and a very smart point, because I've known many people through the years who have said, you know, like, I'll know when things are going to come apart and I'll get my physical then.
Right.
In the meantime, I'll just play the paper game,
right,
because that's where I can trade and make, you know, and make profit.
Right.
And I just want to, you know, mention this. People in India thought that way too.
Good point.
And people in India, you know, the price of gold locally in India has traded up well through $3,000 an ounce. The problem is you can't get any.
Exactly.
There's none available.
Exactly.
See? So it doesn't really matter what the price is if you can't get any. And ultimately, that's the way it will end here too. The price will go up at some point. The price will go up a lot, but it will be irrelevant what the price is, because there will be no physical for sale.
Yeah.
And the paper markets will be discredited, because, you know, all I can say to you, tell an Indian citizen who has a fistful of paper money who can't buy an ounce of gold at over $3,000 an ounce, and remind them that the price of gold is really $1,170.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Or tell them that if they had a certificate that says they have 100 shares of the GLD, just hypothetically, yeah, that they could use that 100 shares of GLD to get some gas for their car and food for their family.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Rob, I got to tell you, I very much appreciate your patience in dealing with my one-man operation here and all of my technical issues today. Your experience and your knowledge is just invaluable, not just to everybody here at TFMR, but everybody that just listened to this podcast. I want to thank you again for that patience, but in your willingness to put this out there for everybody. And hopefully we can try this again, maybe once the calendar flips into the new year, and actually do this in the webinar format so that other folks can ask questions of you as well.
Sure, no problem.
All right, my friend, thank you so much for your time. We'll wrap it up here, and again, we'll try to speak again soon.
Look forward to it.
All right, thanks everybody for listening. We apologize for the issues today. We'll try to do this again next week.